From Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, CBS Radio presents The Great Challenge. This is the fourth of seven special programs that will bring world leaders together to consider urgent problems that face the nation in a rapidly changing world. Today, this CBS News symposium will consider human relations, specifically individual relationships in a mass society. Now, here is the moderator of The Great Challenge, CBS News correspondent Howard K. Smith.
It is now a commonplace that a short while ago, our country was unchallenged in many fields of life that make up a nation's strength. It is also commonplace that now, a short while later, we are very profoundly challenged indeed, even being beaten in some of those fields by a nation that not long ago was very backward. Today we turn to the subtlest challenge of all, for it involves what is still said to be the most tentative of our sciences, the science of the mind. I would like to ask our distinguished guests, are we making progress in freeing the human mind of the neuroses and complexes that beset it? That is more important now than it has been in the past. One of our guests has written that ours is the first generation in history that possesses a veto power over the continued existence of the human race. As we approach this question now, I suggest this for your contemplation. If in the summer of 1945, the neurotic Adolf Hitler had possessed what we possess today, hydrogen weapons in quantity, it is very probable that the human species would not exist on this planet today. That is why this question that has always been with us has now become one of supreme importance. I would like now to introduce our guests. Next to me here on the platform is Dr. Brock Chisholm, who, among many other distinguished accomplishments, has served as the first Director General of the World Health Organization. Dr. Lawrence Kuby, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Yale University. Dr. Ralph W. Tyler, Director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. Dr. Eric Fromm, now professor at the National University of Mexico. Dr. Lionel Trilling, literary critic, educator, professor of literature at Columbia University. And Dr. William Foote White, director of the Social Science Research Center at Cornell University and editor of Human Organization, the Journal of the Society for Applied Anthropology. I would like now to ask Dr. Chisholm to begin by making a statement to us on the general question, is mental health in America in as good a condition as can be expected, or is it in a bad condition? Where do we stand in this particular resource? Is there anything seriously wrong calling for urgent attention?
I suppose that there's a lot wrong with this generation, as there has been a lot wrong with all previous generations, but it's more important now than it used to be, because even if a lot of people in the past couldn't get along together at all and fought each other as they did, the results were usually fairly local. Only a few thousand or occasionally larger numbers of people were killed, but the human race was itself never threatened. In this generation, there is required a whole new attitude that is appropriate to a new kind of world about which our ancestors knew nothing, and the requirements for adjustment to that changed world will probably, I would say, I believe quite certainly, produce more neuroses, or at least liberate or motivate more neuroses, or provide channels for the neurosis that is there already and encourage it to show.
Well, Dr. Kuby, I want to quote from you before I ask you the same question. You said once, any culture will deteriorate precisely to the extent to which it exploits and even rewards every neurotic weakness which it can reach. There is much in our American culture, as in other cultures, that follows this dangerous course. Would you expand on that thought and how we're doing?
The concealed neurotic components are infinitely more important than are the open, manifest, clinical symptoms which we ordinarily think of when we think of neuroses. It's the subtler manifestations of the neurotic process which play a role in the warping and shaping and distorting of human nature, which limit our creativity, which interact constantly with our educational and economic and political and system. And our failure to face this and to realize that that is our primary challenge is something that we're paying now a very heavy price for.
Dr. Tyler?
We do not have the positive side of mental health that is potentially available to us with our great physical development. We find people are much more under a strain of fear. The papers and other mass media are continually emphasizing the dangers from Russia. We are more likely to be interested in doing things because of our desire to be better than somebody else, rather than to capitalize on our own individual opportunities for freedom, for expressing ourselves easily and freely, and for taking advantage of the arts and literature and all the other opportunities that the present day has to offer.
Dr. Fromm.
I think we are about as unhealthy mentally as any society ever could have been. If I could give an example, namely, here we are actually talking seriously about the possibility of a future war. We know consciously and intellectually that this war might lead to the destruction of the human race, and yet we talk about it repressing all affective and emotional reactions to this reality. Now, I think that is a state, a rather pathological state. You mentioned right now the question of fear. Well, fear can be something pathological, but I think the absence of fear can also be something pathological. And I think that is much more the problem today with regard to the possibility of destruction than too great a presence of fear.
Dr. Trilling.
I think that it is natural that we should, with the large development of the psychiatric and psychological sciences, apply those sciences to almost any field of human activity. But I do feel that there is a danger, especially among the intellectual classes of this country, and no doubt of some other countries, among the classes who feel it their duty to be enlightened and informed and to have goodwill, to think of politics primarily in terms of psychology. I think that this is a very natural and very interesting enterprise, but I very much fear the tendency of sensitive and delicate-minded people to reduce the whole question of politics to psychology and to emotions and motives. It seems to me that this is going to make an evasion of certain actualities which cannot be evaded.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Trilling. Now, Dr. White, I'm going to change the subject on you and come very close to the heart of our question of today. It's frequently said that individuality is in great peril in these times, that conformity is growing extremely impressive. What do you think about that tendency? What is the effect of modern institutions on individuality?
I think there's always a tendency toward conformity in any society. Certainly in our history we've seen it. De Tocqueville commented upon it more than 100 years ago. I think our problem is in the relation of the individual to the group and the organization. And here a lot of people are assuming that just the fact that we have a lot of group meetings, that most individuals work in organizations, necessarily stifles individuality. As I've seen it in a variety of organizations, this often happens, but it doesn't necessarily happen.
Now, Dr. White thinks that the pressure of conformity is exaggerated. Does anyone agree or take issue with that? Dr. Chisholm.
I believe that there is a very considerable pressure to conformity. I think primarily because so many people do suffer from a perfectly valid anxiety because situations are entirely different. We know, when we stop and think about it, that none of our institutions was invented or developed for the purposes we want them to serve now. They were developed by our ancestors under quite different circumstances. Our instruments, our ways of doing things may not be appropriate at all for this present situation. I think that is producing a great anxiety, which tends to make people want to get the feeling of being good, because to be good is to be rewarded by security.
Can someone distinguish for me between conformity and normal social cooperation? What is the distinction?
It all depends, I think, what kind of conformity we really are talking about. I think the conformity which we find today in our modern culture, not only in the United States, but all over the Western world, is a conformity which is rooted in the fact that individual feels helpless, isolated, alone, and seeks shelter. But furthermore, that he's not even aware of this. That consciously has the illusion that he's an individualist, that he follows his own idea, and I think that adds only to create a very bad and pathogenic situation.
I take it that what you feel is that there is a growing fear of change itself. Conforming becomes then a rigid pattern which he has to live by, and anything which makes him alter frightens him, and what frightens you always angers you. Therefore, the person who confronts us with the challenge to change stirs up a kind of anger, which I think is new in our culture and very dangerous in our culture.
Dr. Tyler?
I should like to point out that for the common man, that is the garden variety of us, that there is more opportunity now for individual expression in many respects than has ever been true before. We are not limited, for example, by our where we live, and the development of communications like TV, for example, has made it possible for the common man to get a vision of many ways of expressing himself, the way human beings can express themselves, that are far greater than he could have had in a rural village 150 years ago, where he was limited to the particular characters in that village and how they expressed themselves.
There's a popular belief, which is widespread throughout the world, that the pressure to conformity is greater in the United States than it is in other countries. And one knows of examples. I know when I went to school, a junior high school, and a little German boy was introduced among us, because he was different, our reaction was to harass him and to beat him up. My son goes to Denmark, and he's a foreigner there, but they look on him with awe and interest, and he has something special to contribute in their view because he is different. Now, is this conception true? Is it true that America insists on conformity while others do not? Dr. White.
It seems to me it depends upon what you're asking about conforming to, but in terms of changing institutions and purposes of organizations, ways of doing things, that we're remarkably adaptable and willing to do things in new ways. Comparing ourselves with a number of other countries around the world, we would say they're conformists, they're sticking to old habits. It's hard for them to develop innovations, and in fact, what we're trying to do in a number of other countries is to try to help them to be more innovative.
Any other answers on that question? Any?
It seems to me that we can look back a matter of 150 or 200 years and remember a culture in which, if we said that conformity was a bad thing, people would look at us with astonishment. That people living in villages or people living in their particular classes, middle class or peasant class, whatever it was, never had the challenge to them of breaking out of their conformity. Conformity was simply the description of their lives. But now we begin to think of this as a very bad thing.
May I ask you a question about political conformity? It's sometimes said that we have reared a generation who do not know how to carry out political protest, and that this is a result of the McCarthy period. Does any of you who teach agree or disagree with that?
Well, it's certainly not the result of the McCarthy period. I think that's one of the great public fictions. It is true that at the moment there is a considerable diminution of political passion among the young, and in a way I deplore that, but why that is so, I don't know. It seems to me at the moment there are no issues for them to get excited about.
Dr. White.
I think there's been a change in the 20 years or so since I've been in college. There in the Depression period, there was a minority, but a very vocal minority of radicals, but they were people looking for global solutions, socialism or communism or some big solution that would wrap it all up. And I think one of the things that's happened in the intervening years is that people have become more and more suspicious of these global solutions and are more and more looking at problems in detail and recognizing that the nostrums don't work.
Well, gentlemen, I want to shift the topic just a little and talk about the influence of some of the things you've been talking about on politics and on society. Now, we have all been brought up to believe that an atmosphere of freedom is the best atmosphere in which people can be constructive and creative and capable. Yet we find people from a nation which is not free are beating us in many fields, in some respects in science, certainly in the field of propaganda in respect to foreign relations. So I'm going to ask the question bluntly, is freedom really necessary to a creative society? Will someone volunteer an answer on that? Dr. Chisholm.
I would say eventually it is. Under pressure, the pressure of a vision, or the pressure of a drive for power, or a competitive pressure to get ahead of someone else, at least for some time, there may be under a regimentated system, it may be quite possible that tremendous progress can be made. But I believe eventually it will not be sound progress until there is a higher degree of freedom.
Dr. Kuby?
I won't qualify in any way. I'll give an unqualified yes, and for a very specific reason. Conformity can be good or bad. Rebellion can be good or bad. Every infant, every small child starts as a conformist. He's conformed because he feels safe conforming and because he wants to be liked. At a certain point, and quite early, this becomes something which he can no longer control. And he becomes an automatic conformist. And part of the process of maturation then becomes the necessity of freeing himself from this unthinking automatic conformity. And that's a necessary part of growth and development. The adolescent who doesn't rebel isn't worth a darn. But the point comes at which that rebellion can also get out of his control, which it can become automatic. And so that we have a society of automatic conformists, of automatic rebels, and nobody thinking and nobody mature. Nobody is too large, but in which the freedom, the real freedom which maturity brings, has by no means been achieved. And that's the failure, one of the several failures, which I think is a very real failure of our whole educational and cultural process.
Dr. Fromm.
I think many people today raise such questions as about freedom from the standpoint, what is socially more useful? What is more conducive to power and political strength? And here, I think we come across a question of a hierarchy of value. Whether we consider freedom and the dignity of the person and the full individuality or development of individuality of a person a supreme value, and that means whether we are serious with our Western Judeo-Christian humanistic tradition, or whether we begin to think of these things in terms of their usefulness for survival, for their usefulness for military strength or industrial strength and whatnot. Well, that's of course a viewpoint, but I think we should be honest and should either say this humanistic religious tradition is a reality for us, or if we do not really accept this hierarchy of value, we should say no, we throw it out.
Dr. Trilling.
I should like very firmly to underscore what Dr. Fromm has said. We know perfectly well from what history tells us that freedom is not necessary for power. As between Sparta and Athens, there was no question as to where freedom lay in the very simple political sense of the word. Yet it was Sparta who won the Peloponnesian War and Athens that went quite to pieces, perhaps Dr. Fromm would not agree with me, even on the basis of its freedom. But Sparta is in all respects forgotten, except perhaps as a name and a few legends about foxes and things of that kind. And Athens is forever remembered. And I think that one wants to take a very strong stand here and say that this kind of memorableness is of the greatest importance.
Dr. Tyler.
The point is that you cannot be, as an individual, free and able to express all the potentialities you have to think and act in various ways unless you have an opportunity to get stimulation from other people. We want variety in our society because it makes society interesting. If you have to sit with Joe and you know 15 minutes ahead of time exactly what Joe's going to say and how he's going to say it, and many people at their homes or at work find just that relationship, that there's nothing novel, nothing exciting, nothing interesting. Other people bore you and you bore other people. And our concern here is that it's through human relations of a individual sort, an original, a creative sort, that life itself becomes interesting. It's worth living.
Dr. Fromm.
Well, I quite agree with you. I think most people do bore each other, but they repress it. And that a great deal of our activities just serve the purpose of hiding the fact that not only we bore each other, that we are bored with life. And I think while we have a picture of gregariousness, one shouldn't call that in any serious sense satisfying human relatedness, but a great deal a flight and escape from loneliness.
Now, I'm going to, with a wrench, change the subject for a moment. We talked about mental health and about the climate that our society creates. One indication, I think, of mental climate is juvenile delinquency. Now, last week, the Russians issued some figures according to which persons under 18 committed 5% of crimes committed in Russia, while 42% of all crimes committed in America were committed by juveniles under 18. Can any of you say something about the causes of this? What is it in our society that produces these stupendous figures?
I'm very unsure about the validity of any of our statistics on delinquency for many reasons. In the first place, we don't have really a comparative base. They haven't got accurate comparative statistics. We know, and we're also impressed, you see, by the volume of it in certain congested areas. Whether or not that actually represents a percentage increase in terms of the number of youngsters of that age period is far from clear. What is clear is that the quality and the magnitude of the offenses has changed. And for that, I think there are a great many things responsible, which are rather special in our culture. But I think that's a little apart from our
major
topic.
These things do not exist in Russia, do you feel?
No, most of them don't. I mean, nothing like the same extent. Quite frankly, I think the movies, TV, comics, the constant confrontation with killing, bloodletting, in a form so realistic that to a child it's as real as life itself, cannot fail to have an effect not on the impulse to rebel, but on the form that your rebellion will take and what your standard then is of how you express the fact that you're rebelling. Mm-hmm. If you can't rebel except by sticking a knife into somebody, that's what you're going to do.
Dr. Trilling, did you have a comment?
No, I have no comment.
Dr. Fromm.
I quite agree with Dr. Kilby, and I think one might add another thing. The Russians have an exceedingly authoritarian system of education. Now, under this such a system, it stands to reason that the young people will rebel less, will be more afraid, and that it takes some growing up until the young person intimidated by the authoritarian system of education becomes less intimidated in this particular sense. And I think that's another element why these statistics, provided they are correct, represent the facts.
Dr. Tyler, did you have a comment?
I was only going to comment on the point that Dr. Kuby made. In this country, the relationship between congestion and juvenile delinquency is very high, so that the one factor we might want to look into in Russia is the extent to which there is a strong, heavy crowding and lack of playground space and the like for children.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, we've talked a great deal about many problems that are psychological. And as I said in the beginning in my introduction, that is probably the most tentative of all our sciences. I wonder if those of you who are specialists in psychiatry could tell us what progress is being made towards eliminating these inner conflicts which cause external results and consequences.
I'd say, very sadly, almost none. From the point of view of real prevention, we haven't really put our minds or our thoughts or our hearts to that at all. We're just beginning to understand what prevention can mean. That's again why I feel a little bit chagrined if I hear anyone talk about too much psychologizing. I have a feeling that we haven't not really doing a tenth or a hundredth as much as we need if we're ever going to tackle the problem of prevention as we should.
Dr. Fromm?
There is a certain tendency today for psychology and psychiatry to play the role of the human engineer, of making people more adjusted, of accepting the general standard of health which exists in our society, and then make people adjust to it, rather than to start on a basis of a certain concept of what is human nature, what are the basic needs of man based on the conditions of his existence, and what is objectively a state of well-being or a state of not well-being based upon.
Dr. Trilling, the purpose of psychiatry is to remove inhibiting complexes and neuroses. I've met a very few people without inhibitions in my life, and mostly they were insufferable. Tell me, don't you think that if all people were without inhibitions, literature would be very dull?
Oh, yes. Without inhibitions, people would go on forever, for one thing, and never stop their novels.
Aren't you really making the point that you don't wish to have people think that mental health is the same as being a complete bovine existence, chewing our cuds and sitting around?
Based on the most destructive fallacy that's gotten abroad and for which psychiatry and analysis is in part responsible, but is nonetheless a fallacy. That which is most stereotyped, most lacking in individuality and in individual difference in human personality is that which is neurotic. The neurotic is a hell of a banal, stereotyped quality in human beings. It is not the creative thing in human beings at all. The unconscious forces which make us rigid and stereotyped are not the things which produce great works of art or even great science. And this also, the idea that that the goal of psychiatry, of psychotherapy, or of any other type of therapy is to remove all inhibitions is wrong. The goal is to remove the control of the personality by the forces over which one has no knowledge, mm-hmm. so that one is free from internal compulsion, the blind internal compulsion. That doesn't mean you're going to be free from drives and needs.
Dr. Trilling.
Well, I should like first to free myself from the onus which I think Dr. Kuby has put upon me of being an enemy of psychiatry, thinking there is too much psychiatry. But when we look to psychiatry, as we do, to make children have a less difficult time of it, and as adults have a less difficult time of it, then it seems to me that we are at a great distance from the way a culture should operate, which is a good deal more unconsciously, with a sense of its ideals, with a sense of when its ideals are successful. And I would suggest merely that our great concern with psychiatry is an indication of the weakness of our sense of what our culture is.
Dr. White, can you speak briefly now?
We have very little time. I'd like to be a little cantankerous to challenge the assumption that it's a psychiatrist's primary responsibility to handle our mental health problems, because it seems to me that we're living in a world where the individual works and lives in large organizations. If the psychiatrists understand these organizations, they can be of great help to us. By and large, psychiatrists pay little attention to organizations and concentrate on individuals. I find that the picture of organizations that is reflected here doesn't fit with the organizations I've seen in my work in industrial relations at Cornell and elsewhere, so that we seem to be talking about two rather different worlds.
I'm afraid I have to stop us here. The hour has run out, and I have to strive to sum up some of the things you've said. The most conspicuous feature to me is we've talked for an hour largely about psychiatry, and no one has mentioned the word sex once. If we had time, I would like to ask you whether that had any Freudian implications. We have agreed, apparently, that modern times do create more neuroses. Dr. Fromm said that our mental health is about as bad here as it is with any other people at any time. In regard to individuality, Dr. White thinks that the menace is exaggerated. Dr. Chisholm thinks that the hunger for security causes us to seek approval, which means to conform and lose bold individuality. Dr. Tyler thought that there is more chance for many individuals to develop their individuality now than before, due to modern transportation, to modern communications, and so on. The common man has it better, but perhaps the uncommon man does feel the restrictions. With that thought, I bid you thanks and good evening.
You have been listening to The Great Challenge, the fourth of seven special symposiums dealing with the critical issues facing the American people. Today's program considered individual relationships in a mass society. On May 1st, at this same time, The Great Challenge will present a discussion devoted to government and democratic process, decision-making in a democracy. Joining our symposium on May 1st will be noted historians Alan Nevins, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Elmer Schott Schneider. and the distinguished journalists Arthur Kroc, Emmett John Hughes, and Ernest K. Lindley. Howard K. Smith of CBS News will again be moderator. That's Thursday, May 1st. The Great Challenge is produced by James F. Fleming, associate producer Richard Simonofsky. This was a presentation of CBS News on the CBS Radio Network.